We go from writing legal opinions to novels today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Former Iowa State Justice Linda Newman is now writing a novel. Garrison Keillor is occupied with the Writer's Almanac. Join both today on Scribble. I don't know. Does being on the bench really get you in the mood for telling stories?
Oh, I think the cases that you hear are just stories about people. That's really what they are.
But you have to be even-minded or even-handed when you're a justice. Now that you're a novelist, you can do anything you want.
She just whispered she's not a novelist.
But I'm not a novelist.
You are writing something, though.
Oh, no, not really. Am I in the wrong place today?
Yes, no, you certainly are. We slotted a person writing a novel, and you come in here and you tell me you're not writing a novel. Linda, how dare you?
I think I told Roald I was reading novels, and I...
You were writing something, though.
Wow.
Tweet, let's face it.
What would that have been about? But I've done a lot of writing in my career.
Well, that's what I'm interested in, the legal writing, because, you know, nothing is much so made fun of as legalese.
Absolutely,
right?
And it should be made fun of.
But you can't cover up the fact that your synapses got switched again.
Well, they did. Yes. Age is creeping up on me, Don.
I have a number of friends who've been encouraging me to write a memoir, but, oh, you know, the days go by day, and the days seem to be filled with other things besides writing a memoir.
Well, you know, writing, and particularly in the law, when I looked at friends who were lawyers, I thought, that's why I was never interested in being a lawyer. You had to spend all your time reading and writing. And you have to research cases and find precedents and so on and find the tortuous path around to winning, quite frankly, whether it's just or not, but to get to winning. And a judge or justice has to sort through all this to see that things are procedurally correct, but also to try to find the truth in it. That's got to be tough, Linda.
Well, it is, because there are certain constraints, obviously, in one's analysis and delivering an opinion. And yet I was just talking to Jay Pierce just briefly about the fact that, as I mentioned before, cases are really stories about people. And so every case that you decide, the one that you're given to work on, has usually interesting characters, or characters anyway.
Yeah.
Mostly interesting. There's always a plot of some kind. There's always some conflict or dispute going on, and it's up to the judge to resolve it. At the trial court level, you're often just leaving it up to a jury to decide, and you may be pronouncing judgment or sentence. But at the appellate level, and I did that for 17 years, you're taking all this written work, and it comes in boxes. At that time, it came in boxes, you know, and you're whittling it down to the story about this case and what people, citizens, and lawyers are to take from that case. And so, you know, you can't go too far afield. Your decision has to be based on precedent. But in order to make it even interesting enough to read, you need to treat it like a story. There are facts. You tell the story of what went on. You describe the people, and then you talk about the law and resolve the case.
So, at the state level, are there dissenting opinions and majority opinions and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. Although,
Who gets assigned what?
Well, in our case, they were just assigned in kind of chronological order. They just literally from the date a case came in, they just lined us up and you know, you they just rotated, basically.
Okay.
You just got the next case. It wasn't based on any particular expertise you had in a particular area of the law.
But didn't it make a difference whether you were on the dissenting side or the majority side?
Oh, sure. The case was assigned, and then you would, after hearing the argument and having done the background work on the case, you would describe to your colleagues how you thought a case should come out. And again, you're kind of summarizing
right.
the facts and the dispute and so forth. And then if everybody pretty much agrees with you tentatively in an oral sort of way,
right.
then you'd get the opinion to write. But sometimes we would talk about an opinion just wouldn't write. It's one thing to talk about a dispute or a conflict in the law. It's another thing to have it make sense on paper. We used to say, well, this opinion just wouldn't write the way I thought it was going to come out. And you'd have to kind of change horses in the middle of the stream sometimes. Anyway, you might float a draft of an opinion and your colleagues might not agree with you anymore the way it's written, in which case someone else would pick it up
and then
I'd have to write a dissent.
And what about you yourself? Well, we've had a number of writers on here who describe that in the act of writing, their own opinions change.
Exactly. Exactly.
So does that happen to it at that legal level too?
Yeah, and that's what I mean about sometimes you'll think a case ought to come out a particular way, and as you write it, it just won't stay on the paper. I mean, that sounds kind of odd, but that's the way it is. You think, this isn't coming out right. It's not fair. It's not accurate. It's not correct. I can't make the facts fit into the law, or I can't make that reach that you always make as a judge in a court of last resort where you're kind of making the leap from the known law to the next interpretation of that law, and it just doesn't work.
So at what point does the kind of writing you're talking about take place? Before there's been a final vote, or?
No, it usually comes out in two stages. There's kind of, after you've heard the argument,
right.
There's kind of a preliminary vote, and then the person who's assigned to write the opinion goes back and works on it, and before the next gathering of the court, which might be in 3 weeks
okay.
or something, you have a draft. And most of the time, people will go with the draft, but there are going to be changes. There are contributions that each of us would make to the writing of opinions by other judges.
Mm-hmm. How much latitude is there? I'm charmed by the way Supreme Court Judge Antonin Scalia used to get his licks in, which I thought was very unjudicial, but, you know, that's you have that kind of freedom at that level, I guess.
Well, you know, his one of his favorite colleagues, I think, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, used to eschew that kind of throwing that sort of stuff in, particularly about your colleagues. And she would say, and this is one of my favorite phrases, was get it right and keep it tight. Opinions that kind of go off and on about a lot of philosophical things or whatever are not very valuable to the folks who are just trying to figure out what is the decision in this case and how does it apply to future cases. So talking about whether your colleagues aren't smart enough or on the wrong track or whatever doesn't really add a lot of value to the opinion. But there's no question that Scalia had a very unique style and his opinions were interesting to read.
Mm-hmm. But,
not everyone, not all of the opinions are interesting to read.
Would somebody be able to, just from the style, tell a Linda Newman opinion from someone else?
That's a great question, Roel, and I think so. Because my way of doing it would be my clerks would really do the research, and they'd write a memo. And if they had said something great in a memo, I didn't mind putting in an opinion. But what I usually did was take it and kind of start all over again and write the opinion the way I thought it made sense to me. I once did have a student who was working then for a judge in a court, and he was reading an opinion one day, and he said, and I hadn't really paid attention to who wrote it, and then he said, and then it started sounding like somebody I knew. And they went back and said, oh, it's a Linda Newman opinion. I thought that was kind of cool.
Okay.
Yeah,
so there can be that variation.
Sure.
Well,
you develop your own sort of style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that people observe about the way the courts work is how slowly it goes. Everything seems to take forever. Why is that?
Well, a couple of reasons, I suppose. Life is complicated. Decisions are sometimes hard to make. And lawyers, I think, by nature, tend to be sort of procrastinators, so they can kind of put things off and just not get at it. But there's no particular reason for things to take so long. I think, you know, they really, the law does a disservice to the citizens when it takes too long for a decision to be made. On the other hand, we used to say, you know, there's justice delayed is justice denied, but justice rushed is just as bad. That's kind of a little, you know, phrase, and it's true,
you know,
too.
I have some friends who are lawyers, and I thought, you guys waste a lot of time, because a case will come in, and they'll assemble the papers and set them aside, and then go on to another case, and then set that aside. And another one, in the meantime, the first client is waiting, waiting, waiting. And you think, there has to be a better way to do this.
Well, I agree with that, and there are, you know, different ways to do it. Kind of back to the opinion writing, my view always was to try to write as briefly and concisely as I could. And as you guys probably know, it's easier to write long than it is to write short. And that was always a challenge. And I think my clerks were often surprised that I could take this body of work that they'd been working on a case and really narrow it down to something that I thought was, we got to the point. We said we had to say, the reasoning was there, but we didn't go on and on and on. Opinions are often way too long.
And that is true. It's so much easier to write at length.
Yeah.
Then you discover when you finish something and you read it, you think, I could cut this in half.
Well, and I did that a lot. After I retired from the court, I taught for 10 years at the Iowa Law School, and I worked with the students in particular who were working as interns with federal judges. And I knew all the judges, and so they were glad to have me look at these drafts. They knew I didn't care particularly about who the parties were, any conflicts sort of there at all. And I would look at the drafts that the students were doing, and we'd talk a lot about word flab. I mean, you could just go through and take out a lot of what they'd written, just repetitive things that we tend to say in sentences, or their thought that if you said something in one paragraph, you'd have to remind the reader again two paragraphs later that you'd already said it. And, you know, I'd kind of ask them about those things. And I think they like that idea of word flab. Let's get rid of the word flab.
Yeah, it's. I find that in stories I read, you go along and you think, wait a minute, didn't we just deal with this in the last chapter? Why are we going over this again? But some writers do that. I guess they figure readers forget. And it is true that when I read a mystery novel, I can't be sure that I remember anything at the beginning. Because you zip through.
Right.
That's so true. And if I could just say, Roland and I had been talking about a book that I was listening to on Audible, IQ84 by Haruki Murakami. And he's a Japanese author. And it's an incredibly long book. It was over 40 hours just to listen to on Audible. Now, from time to time, it was helpful when he reminded the reader or the listener of some of those details that you mentioned, Don. But by and large, boy, he's a great writer. And aside from the fact that this was an awfully long novel, it was very well written.
Yes. One of the things that used to really astound students in the sciences and law and, you know, going out to those professions is how much of their life actually involved writing. They thought, I'm going to be a scientist. I'm going to be a geologist. I won't have to do any writing. To discover that probably 40% of their writing is writing for grants, writing up reports, writing their research. How much of your day was spent writing? Do you have any estimate?
Oh, while I was on the Iowa Supreme Court, the majority of a day would be done
writing.
That was always the hardest part. There was a lot of reading to be done. There was a lot of discussing things with colleagues on administrative matters and that sort of thing. But the hardest part and the most focused work was always in the writing.
You would write rather than dictate?
Yeah. In fact, later in my career, we actually, you know, got computers and I would do it on a computer. But I wrote out opinions in longhand on a yellow pad with a HB10 mechanical pencil for a long time.
Really?
Well, you know, I mean, I did this in the 80s. Yeah. But I was never very good at dictating. I had colleagues who would dictate, but I always felt I had to write.
Do you miss it?
Less now than I did right after I retired. I mean, I realized after I retired from the court that I really enjoyed writing, and I had honed that skill some over the years. I don't miss it that much now. It's been a while.
Yeah, once you walk away from something and deliberately walk away, then it gets easier as time goes.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And that's a good thing to do.
Well, there's more to life, you know, than being a judge on the Supreme Court.
So why aren't you writing a novel?
Well, I think you convinced me that you could.
Well, I don't know about that. And there's it's one thing writing it, is another doing it successfully. I think I tend to be a little hard on myself in terms of my own writing, and I wouldn't be inclined to get it out there very easily.
You know, that is true. Every time I think of writing, I think of really good writers, and I think, why am I wasting my time here when the good stuff is already done? But same way, when I was taking singing lessons, I was working so hard on this aria, and then I heard a Metropolitan Opera guy sing it, and I thought, I'll never be able to do that. Why am I even bothering, you know? And my voice teacher was furious. He says, never listen to Leonard Warren. Just work on your own voice. But the damage had been done.
No, I think you're really right, Don, in terms of not being too critical of yourself. And I think even in the writing that I did, or what writing I have done, I gave a lot of speeches, a lot of, you know, talks, and these opinions and so forth. What's interesting to me is that I can go back and look at an opinion that maybe I wrote in 1997 or 1992. And I'm pleased to see it still hangs together. Yeah, no. When you're working on it, you know, you're kind of, like in any writing, I think you're pretty excited maybe at the outset. And then you get in the middle right. And you think, why in the world did I think I could do this? And then you get right. To the end and you're so glad you're done. Right. And it isn't until weeks later or months later, or years later, you read back and you go back and you think, well, that wasn't a bad piece of work.
It's always a pleasant surprise when I look back and find something I'm not ashamed of.
Right.
Exactly.
Linda Newman, it is a pleasure to talk to you. And I, you know, we really want you to write a novel. But, you know, a memoir is not bad either.
Well, thanks for letting me be here today. And I'm sorry I didn't know what my assignment was.
Well, we don't know what our assignment is ever. I still think Linda Newman ought to write a novel.
I think she should.
Well, you're the one to prod her into it.
Well, let me recommend a couple of mysteries that might get her going. Bill Hebert gave me a book a month or so ago, and I finally got around to it. It's a mystery by Anthony Horowitz. I've never read anything by Anthony Horowitz, but it turns out he's the head writer on Foyle's War on public television and also the head writer on Midsummer Murders.
Hmm.
So he's got a respectable pedigree. But this book is called The Magpie Murders, and it's interesting in that it's one of those books inside a book. The inside book is by supposedly a writer named of mysteries named Ellen Conway, who writes mysteries that are kind of like spoofs on Agatha Christie, including a detective that sort of makes fun of Hercule Poirot. The detective in this particular book, the book is called Magpie Murders, is Atticus Pund.
Now wait, before you go any further in this, don't give the plot away because I've got this book set aside to read.
Well, okay.
Entice me.
It turns out that Conway turns in this manuscript of this book, Magpie Murders, and the editor is reading it as we read it. Mm-hmm. Only the last chapter is missing. And Ellen Conway, it turns out, himself is mortally ill and dies. And the editor of the publishing firm, I'm trying not to give this away, Don. The editor of the publishing firm has to find out whether Conway's death was suicide or whether it really was a cleverly disguised murder, so that as the editor investigates her writer's murder or suicide, you get a second mystery story. So you get two mystery stories for one, and it is surely delightful. The styles in the two books are completely different.
Well, that's interesting.
And how you move, how she is able, Horowitz is able to move back and forth between that is just amazing.
Style is something that eludes me in a way. That, you know, when you think I want to write in a style, I just keep writing like myself. I can't adjust. And yet when you run into a novel or anything that's written in a certain style, you certainly follow it. And you recognize it's a style.
There is, in fact, in this book, a third style, because Conway, it turns out, is trying to write serious fiction. He always resented having to write mystery stories, and he's only doing it because they're popular. So he turns in a couple of chapters of a novel that is high literature, and it's awful. So Horowitz is dealing with three different styles in three different situations. It's very interesting. So I would get to reading it if I were you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I pulled out a stack of mysteries. I found a bunch of I read John le Carré's, I don't know what to call it. It's a kind of a notebook. When someone wrote a biography of him, he responded by writing his own version of things. In particular, his relationship with his father, who was an utter scoundrel, a charming scoundrel, a Falstaffian scoundrel in many ways. But he really marked le Carré's life, or George Cornwell, I guess his name is. But I decided I really have to read more le Carré, because I know he's written stuff.
Right.
So I have a stack of books with John le Carré that I have yet
to go
through.
Too many books.
Yeah.
I want to repeat, somebody stopped me. We went out to eat last night, and somebody at the next table came over and said, on Scribble, be sure you repeat the name of the author and the book you're recommending. So this is Anthony Horowitz's Magpie Murders.
Horowitz, H-O-R-O-W-I-T-Z?
Yes, exactly.
And it's, as I recall, says kind of a red cover, got a magpie
on
it. Got
a black magpie on it. Yes, it does.
And when it came out, there was quite a stir about it, because already people were recognizing that this was going to be a bestseller.
Well, it's fun, however, on so many different levels.
Yeah, well, okay.
Now, another book?
Another book.
I want to recommend Louise Penny, and her latest book is Glass Houses. Louise Penny, if you have never read a Louise Penny, you've got to get started right now and go back and read the very first one. This is the 13th. The first one is called Still Life. But this one, it takes Adam Gamache, who is her detective, and he's now head of the entire police force in Quebec. And he is faced with the problem of committing a crime in order to prevent a much larger crime from happening, and whether that is morally right or not. It is a serious crime that he's going to have to commit, for which he will lose his job, and everybody that he suckers into the plan will also lose their jobs. So it's serious. Louise Penny always is interested in life and what it means to live the kind of moral life, and is it to do the wrong thing for the right reason. Is that ever justified? And the example given here is what happened to Coventry in World War II. Just before Coventry was bombed, the British had solved the Enigma Code. And so they knew Coventry was going to be bombed. If they had prevented Coventry from being bombed, the Germans would have known they'd solved the code and gone to another code. So that in order to preserve the secrecy, they think the British hierarchy, including Churchill, permitted Coventry to be bombed and hundreds of people to be killed. But it saved thousands of lives after that.
You know,
is that right?
That is a great dilemma. I have been to Coventry, been to it two or three times. During our London trips, I always went down to Coventry. and part of the city is medieval. You have to be careful when you walk along a street. It starts to curve, and you're not sure where you're winding up.
Right.
The other half is brand new, all glass and modern stuff. That part was completely obliterated. The amazing thing is that the big cathedral is still there. And also the church with the head of, I'm going to lose my history here. Who was the guy, Man for All Seasons? Anyway, his head was preserved in one of the church at the other end of town. Beckett at one end and Moore at the other.
Right.
Those are still there, but so much of the town, you could just draw a line. And one half of the town is spanking new and the other half is medieval. It is an interesting contrast. But yeah, that's to do something wrong to prevent a greater wrong. Or in this case, to win a war, because solving Enigma was just a heck of a thing.
It was. I mean, anyway, Louise Penny is as good as she ever has been, and I hope she keeps writing. But as I said, if you haven't read Louise Penny, all of her novels take place in or around, almost all of them, in a little manufactured town called Three Pines.
I read the first one, and when I saw she was doing more, I thought she's going to depopulate this town if she's not careful.
Well, a few people, it's like Jessica Fletcher, right, in Cabot Cove. And her characters are so well done. The dilemma here about the future, I mean, it also raises the question of whether eventually the criminals are going to win out. They seem to be winning the drug war, for instance, now, the opium war and stuff, and this has a great part in this book. The question that Louise Penny raises is the future of our civilization the end of that little children's dance, ashes, ashes, we all fall down, or is it all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. Where are we going?
You ask a question like that, and you move into the world we're living in now.
Well,
we are moving in ways that we cannot control, and we're not sure that good things are going to happen.
Well, that is at the heart of this book. So Louise Penny is more than just a mystery writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to denigrate mysteries. They're good. But she always has larger game in mind.
Well, I always liked Ross McDonald because he seemed to pick up on themes in his mysteries that you find running through important works of literature on the mass market.
Right.
And somebody who can do that, who can turn a form into something that goes well beyond the form. Yeah, that's someone to admire. I've got to turn a button here so we can turn our admirable music on and escape the place. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you again for being with us. We have more scribbles in the future, and we hope they are in your future as well.